Janie, you told me you couldn't believe in someone that didn't believe in you. Well, I believed in you. I always believed in you.
Oh, Jake.
Oh, God. I can't believe you fell for that crap.
That's from Pretty in Pink. Are you sure?
Trust me.
Excuse me. What are you doing?
Let me give you a little piece of advice here, Jake.
Why don't you lose the I'm the cute and sensitive popular boy with a big sideburns routine? It's just too pathetic. And for once, tell Janie what's true in your heart. Stop being such a little bitch.
But I was just trying to tell...
Oh, don't even use that eyebrow move on me. It's not gonna work.
You do overuse that move.
Oh, and you, Janie.
Little Miss Other Side of the Tracks, awkward rebel girl with the pseudo-intellectual glasses. Why don't you wise up to Jake's bullshit? Stop being such a dumbass.
Lights, camera, action. Welcome back to another episode of Happy Hour Films. As you all know, I'm Ross Bacon. I'm joined by my co-host, Mike McGuigan. Mike, say hi.
How's everyone doing?
And as you should know by now, we're two dudes who drink and we talk about movies. Now, we are in week two of Rom-Com Roulette, which is November, where I just let my wife spin a wheel and pick our movies for this week, each week. So, last week, we had some truly heinous garbage in Sweet Home Alabama. Some just fine garbage in Proposal. And then the other just fine. Okay, this is fine. Birds of Prey, Harley Quinn, Fantabulous, Emancipation. So, this week, week two, we had, like before, there were five options that were spun on the wheel. The rom-coms that we were going to be subjected to. Now, three of these are definitely rom-coms. One of these is... Yes, it fits the scenario and formula of a rom-com, but I don't think anyone would actually call it a rom-com. And it's borderline the good movie that we would have had to watch. So that was Groundhog Day. Now, that not a lot of people would say that's a rom-com. People would just like that's just a comedy with Bill Murray in it. But when you think about it, it is a rom-com. It's just a
comedy that has a romance plot that plays a major role.
Yeah, it's just a Bill Murray, like, romantic comedy of sorts. It's a comedy where he falls in love, basically. But then the true romantic comedies, we had Something's Gotta Give. And then the two that were picked, which was Pretty in Pink and 10 Things I Hate About You. Now, then there was the good one that was thrown in that we actually did get as well, which was Die Hard with a Vengeance.
And a perfect swing this week would have been Die Hard with a Vengeance, Groundhog Day, and 10 Things I Hate About You. I think that would have been the best three to pull.
Yeah, that would have been three entertaining, fun.
I wouldn't have had too much bad to say about any of them. Like, I have some critiques to 10 Things I Hate About You, but all of them would have been a fun enough watch.
Yeah, they would have been fine. But so that's what we were working with this week. Now, before we get into any of that, though, we got to talk about what we're drinking. So, Mike, what do you got?
All right, so I went to, I was at Westville Brewery today, and I picked up a 4-pack of their Apple Pie Crumb Cake Pale Ale, sitting at 6.3%.
Nice, nice.
Now, I love their crumb cake line, and the apple pie is good, but I'm missing the sugar rim that they put on it. Brown sugar rim that they put on at the brewery. So drinking it out of a can, not quite as good without the sugar rim.
Nice, nice. Yeah, and like I said, last few weeks I am working through some Oktoberfest beers. And tonight I'm starting off with Toppling Goliath, which is in actually Decorah, Iowa. And it's their limited edition Oktoberfest Lager. And it's 5.2%, so it's a little lower on the Oktoberfest Marzen scale, which is usually floating right about 6%. But it's delicious, like usual. It's yet another one that's actually very good.
All right.
So, that said, let's get into the good movie. Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1995, directed by the psychopath John McTiernan. Now,
this movie was partially an inspiration for, like, our first legitimate theme with Bad, Better, Best. Or second legitimate theme.
Yeah.
That's a because I came up with bad, better, best looking at Jeremy Irons, and I was saying bad Aragon, better Die Hard with a Vengeance, best The Lion King.
Yeah, yeah. And did we actually do that?
I think we did.
I don't remember anything from like our original year. I don't remember any of the things we did. So it's but yeah. I mean, this movie is Jeremy Irons as Simon Peter Gruber. He was Hans Gruber's brother. You know, I just love the way that dude in the van delivers that line. Like every word of it is supposed to just devastate John McClane.
We did not do this for Bad, Better, Best, by the way. Went back and checked.
Well, I remember watching Aragorn for some reason. We did that for some reason.
We eventually did. It might have been the month where I said, let's do live action and then an animated role.
Yeah, that I think that might have been it. Yeah, because then we probably did Lion King with it, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't remember. Like I said, I don't remember anything from like that first week or so, that first year or so. But except for our first couple episodes that we did like on our phones.
Yeah.
Which were not good.
Good time there.
Yeah. But this one, obviously, is the third Die Hard. It is still in the realm of the good John McClanes. The John McClane is still a character. The one that's not just a fucking bald superhero,
this
you know?
This is the second best Die Hard behind the original.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it makes sense because there's a connection between the two.
We're adding Samuel L. Jackson to the formula.
Absolutely. And you can't go wrong with 1995 Samuel L. Jackson playing Zeus Tarver, the quote unquote angry black man that has every reason to hate white people because it's the 90s and he lives in Harlem, you know?
And also, like, who could hate a plot where Jeremy Irons is just sending you around the city doing like riddle type shit, puzzles.
I'm ready to do riddles and shit. Yeah. It's all he does. Like, it's so
he's the
funny.
Riddler. He's the Riddler with a cool accent.
Right, exactly. And it's funny because the whole thing that it ends up being that John figures out, he's like, I know the family, you know, it's like, which is funny because he only knows one member of the family, and it just turns out that he's right about the second member of the family. That they would much rather have you believe that they blew up a whole bunch of money as opposed to them actually just stealing it. And it's funny because this time, as opposed to McClane being thrust into the plan to be the monkey wrench, this time he is integral to the plan. Like, him being sent around New York is part of the distraction and part of the plan. And it's even funnier because when you think about the actual plan, if they were to go through with everything, they would basically just be sniped at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
And then they would just find McClane's dead body at Yankee Stadium. That's about it. He would have never made it to you know, Canada and all that shit. He would have just been dead in Yankee Stadium. But of course he's John McClane, so he's not gonna go and do what you tell him to do. He's gonna figure shit out, he's gonna fuck up your whole plan, all that kind of shit.
But this movie, like, all the action set pieces in this movie are a ton of fun. Like, it's clearly not as good as Die Hard. But as far as sequels go, this is one of my favorites. I love this movie.
It's awesome because, and it's a perfect sequel because the original is located in one building. You are just going through the building, fighting terrorists. And in naturally, in sequel law, you have to expand the universe. So now we are in the entire city of New York. And we're just running around.
Like,
we're
a big train ending sequence that's a ton of fun with the action in it.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's even from the very beginning. Like, we start off with hot town, summer in the city, and then, like, we're just going, oh, this is just a day in summer in New York, and all of a sudden a building blows up, and you're like, oh, shit, we are hitting the ground running. Because that is the slowest part of the movie. Because after that, it is a sprint to the end, and it's just it's not really a sprint, it's just a fast marathon to the end, you know? Like, we do not take a break for anything. We are just moving, and the plot is moving, the movie's moving, everyone is going. And
this run for Samuel L. Jackson had to be great. Like, I'm trying to go back and see what exactly, like, what movies came out in this run. But, like, you got 93 right Jurassic this. Park, 94 Pulp Fiction, 95 this.
No. Yeah.
Like, this is Samuel L. Jackson becoming Samuel L. Jackson in this run.
Absolutely. In Jurassic Park, of course, he had to be, you know, PG-13, so he can only say, hold on to your butts. And he's great in that movie. Then, of course, he's let loose in Pulp Fiction. He's absolutely let loose in this. So you get that, like, amazing Samuel L. Jackson cursing, and it's just phenomenal. Like, his whole speech about, because in the beginning, when McClane keeps calling him Jesus instead of Zeus, he's like, you know, like, Father of the Gods, Mount Olympus, don't put me on, shove a lightning bolt up your ass. It's so great, because to have that partner with McClane is great, because we hadn't gotten that before. The black guy that helps McClane before was Reginald Vell Johnson in the original, who was just a cop on the ground, like being the radio between the connection between the two. In the second one, there is, I can't remember the character's name, but it's the dude in the air traffic control tower. He's kind of helping out eventually. But then this one, you have side by side Bruce and Samuel L. Jackson, and they are partners in this, and they have to go.
And they're like back and forth, like they're at first like very kind of there's animosity between them.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because of the way it starts off, their relationship starts off, and it's because Simon makes John go to Harlem. The middle of Harlem, drops him off with a sandwich board on the front of it, says, I hate N-words. And it's like, and just the look on McClane's face. And this is how you know that Bruce Willis was still like giving a shit about acting, and especially about John McClane, because the look on his face when he passes that old black woman and he's got that look of like, oh, Jesus Christ, that's not the first person. This is not the person I wanted to see this. You know, he's like, I feel like shit having the fact like that she has to see this. So it's like, I would think that the later John McClane would probably be like, oh, this is annoying. You know, it would be like, he would try to shrug it off, as opposed to you can tell that this still gets to McClane. Like, yeah. Like him being perceived as a racist, as like the most awful of racists, was really painful to him.
And then the other thing in this movie is a blonde, younger Jeremy Irons, as unsettling to you as it is to me.
He's got that fashion mullet and everything. Yeah.
And like the sunglasses. Like, if you watched Sandman on Netflix, he kind of looks like the, I can't remember the bad guy's name in Sandman. Fuck.
What's his name? Boyd Holbrook or whatever?
Yeah.
The guy with the teeth.
The Corinthian.
Yeah. But yeah, well, I thought he looked like Gary Oldman, Bram Stoker's Dracula, but with like the fashion mullet. But yeah, I mean, but then speaking of him, obviously Simon Gerber, German brother, younger brother of Hans Gerber, but he has gotten together the all-star team of Aryan henchmen. Like, these dudes are all like 6'7", just giant Nazi motherfuckers. It's like, where did we get this gigantic group of like Nazi criminals, basically? Like, is there a henchman R Us in Germany that you could just pick these dudes from? Because if these dudes are in the military, like we're saying, I don't know how we won World War II. Don't know.
But so Jeremy Irons is one of those people that I just can't imagine being young. And like in this, he's not young. He's like 47.
He's younger, yeah.
He's younger. But I'm like, I see him in this, and I'm like, no. Jeremy Irons couldn't have ever been a child. He came into existence as an older man with a cool voice.
Exactly. Exactly.
he's like Morgan Freeman, but with a more aggressive voice.
Right. Yeah, more like villainous voice, basically. And it's funny because it's funny you mentioned Morgan Freeman. Like, yeah, that's a dude you look at and you, when you see him young, you're like, that he still doesn't look that young. You know, yeah. he still kind of looks like an older man. But
this is also the single best casting for siblings because Jeremy Irons, you can't convince me that him and Alan Rickman aren't related. Like, they're somewhere. That somewhere they are related.
Yeah, and it would have been, I mean, and I'm sure it's some small movie somewhere. If they were in a movie together that they weren't playing siblings, like, that would have been, that's a crime right there. Because just their attitudes, it's funny because their attitudes are very similar towards their heists and all that. Except when it turns personal for Hans, that's when he like turns it on a little bit, but it begins personal for Simon, and he's almost gearing his plan to, he's like, all right, I'm gonna fuck with McClane. Oh, by the way, the Federal Reserve is also in New York. I can rob that line while I fuck with McClane. And it's just so great that every little part of this movie, and this is again back when Die Hard still cared, every part of this movie is a 90s action movie. It is a classic. It's a incredibly well-directed movie, and it's an incredibly well-written movie. Everything leads to everything else. Like, there, it really isn't anything that you can look at, and if you remove it, the plan falls apart. Because there still is aspects of the plan that are upheld, like the sniper in Yankee Stadium. The only person that ends up going to Yankee Stadium is Samuel L. Jackson. And he's not shot by the sniper because he is not John McClane. And that's the thing that I love, that even though Samuel L. Jackson, that Zeus, had to get involved because he's a good guy and didn't want to see McClane get killed. Now, the great reason that he says that is, like, I saved one white cop from getting killed today. Because if one white cop gets killed today, we got 1,000 white cops tomorrow with itchy trigger fingers. And I was like, well, yes, that is the 90s NYPD, but that's also a way to predict the future, Zeus. But, like, he can tell he's just a good person.
Yeah.
So Simon recognizes that he is as he calls him, the Samaritan. But he recognizes that he's not part of this. Like, so any aspect or any chance he gets to kill Samuel Jackson, it's really as a result of something McClane would do. Mm-hmm. And when he gets the chance to just kill him by himself, he doesn't do it. Like, when he tells the cops that Samuel Jackson's going to give the elephant bomb to, he's on the phone with the one guy. And the guy's like, yeah, I'm going to need resolution on that issue. And he's like, let him go. And he's like, well, you see, he's not trying to kill real, like, actual people. He just wants McClane.
Yeah.
And granted, the people that were injured or killed in the opening scene bombing, collateral damage, maybe. Anybody killed in the train, maybe collateral damage, but it's the main target.
It's one McClane. Of those things where it's like one of those gray areas where Batman doesn't kill Ra's al Ghul at the end of Batman Begins, but he's like, I don't have to save you. You're basically killing him.
You're still killing him. You know, not saving him is killing him.
But no, like, that is one of the things where it's like, so he absolutely is a villain, like, and has villainous intent, but he does have morals.
Yeah, there is a line with him, and it's specifically shown in the bomb in the school scene, where it's just a wild goose chase. That's all it is, and it's just to get everybody distracted and everybody looking the other way while he steals the gold. And so that's funny when McClane's like, there was no bomb in the school, was there? He's like, no, John. He's like, I may work for monsters. He's like, I'm not a monster, even though sometimes I may work for monsters. It's like, right there, that's the line that shows that this dude, while psychotic, isn't completely nuts. You know, he has that moral line where he's a mercenary, but he's not a kill everyone mercenary. You know, he's not like a hitman. You know, he's just a guy who does plots, but has a line. And in this case, the bonus was killing the guy who killed his brother, you know? And what even cracks me up, though, is the only thing you can look at in this movie and maybe say that it's kind of a drawback, because for all intents and purposes, this is basically a perfect movie. And
it's as good of a sequel as you get, besides, absolutely. Like, I mean, like, obviously there are sequels like The Godfather Part 2 or like, Empire Strikes Back and stuff like that, but This is up. Like, it's not on that elite level, but it's good.
Well, I put it up there because everything in it, like, builds on the movie before, but doesn't just redo it, you know? And, like, everything with John's personal life. Like, John is not in a good place when we meet John in the beginning of this movie. Holly has left him for over a year now. They've been, quote-unquote, separated. He hasn't seen his kids. He's a drunk. He's an alcoholic. He's been suspended for something. You know, we don't know what it is, but they basically pick him up out of a gutter in the beginning of this movie. And the gag with him the whole movie is that he says, I had this bad fucking headache because he's hungover. And what cracks me up, though, is the one thing you can look at and go, you know what, this is a bit heavy-handed, but it is a sign of the times it was written in, is the race aspect of it. Yeah. Now, the fact that Zeus is so adamant and against white people, simply for the fact that they're white, is A, not cool, but B, in 1995, in Harlem, you could absolutely understand his point of view. And it is completely justified for him to be very distrustful of cops and white people, let alone white cops. And what kind of rubs me the wrong way, but it is addressed well in the movie, is that, yes, he's basically racist the whole movie, but McClane calls him on his shit almost every chance he gets.
And it's kind of like the South Park episode with where Chef's trying to get the flag changed. Where he's like, the flag was so racist, it almost went and turned me racist.
Right. But it's like, yeah, and it's funny because McClane even does call him a racist at one point. And it's like, yeah, because John McClane would not put up with this shit, but he's also right. You know, it's like, you're dealing with a man who's, yes, the version of the person that you hate. He is a white cop. You do not like white cops, so this is a problem. He has now brought you into a terrorist plot, which is not good either. He's done it by lying to you, which is funny, because he doesn't know he lied to him at first. He doesn't know that the bomb was not found in Harlem. It was found in Chinatown. But even by the time, and McClane does admit that at the end, he's like, I guess I'm going to clear my conscience before we get blown up on this ship. He's like, they found the bomb in Chinatown, not Harlem. He's like, that's low, even for a white motherfucker like you. He's like, well, yeah, but you guys have kind of become friends at this point. So now he's basically just like, as a friend, he's telling you, look, man, I'm sorry you were involved with this. I'm going to lay it all out there. This sucks. But at the same time, he's like, we're going to get out of this. He works his heart to try to get this man to survive, which is what they end up doing. But there are parts of it where if you were to write this movie now, I think that the racist angle of it would go one of two ways. It would be either so on the nose and boring and surface level that you'd almost dismiss it immediately, or it would be so overwritten and it'd be so to the point where it would become annoying and be like, look, did you write anything else in this movie besides the racist part? You know? And there are no subtleties.
Now, there is a third option. It goes under the radar. It's weird as fuck. And it doesn't make a ton of money, but it's pretty good. And that's the Sorry to Bother You way of it going.
Imagine Die Hard with a Vengeance with horse people. Part of Simon's plan involves horse people with giant dicks. That would be very interesting if all the German henchmen suddenly turned into horse people with dicks, with giant dicks. That'd be fun. But yeah, and it's, you know, the whole movie is so great at building tension and suspense.
I love how Samuel Jackson and Bruce Willis, like, their chemistry when they're like trying to solve the puzzles and stuff. It's super entertaining.
Yeah, and then it's the one thing that does crack me up, because Samuel Jackson was actually listening to McClane rather than trying to say what he does end up saying, it's the elephant scene where they're putting the elephant bomb and they're arguing over the jugs. And John McClane's about to call him. He's like, give me the jug, you dumb mother. And then Samuel Jackson interrupts and goes, say it. You were going to call me an N-word, weren't you? And he's like, no, I was going to call you an asshole. It's like, no, John, you were clearly in the middle of calling him motherfucker. You know, it's like, so I know, Zeus, you're all keyed up on the race aspect of it, but if you actually heard the words he was saying, he was definitely going to call you a motherfucker. He was not going to call you an N-word, you know?
Now, it would have been funny if it was like an in-character moment for Samuel L. Jackson where he's like, no, I call you motherfucker. You don't get to call me motherfucker.
You're the motherfucker, motherfucker. Yeah, it was really great. But and it's even better is when you look at this movie, and in it's one of those movies that after you see the whole thing, the line stands out because it's one of those movies where the villain tells you the ending. Yeah. And it's when it's right after the payphone scene in the beginning with the fat lady on the payphone. And he says there's a bomb and blow it up, and he sends them off. And they all start scattering. Well, then we're shown Jeremy Irons looking down that comes up to Jeremy Irons. And the first thing he says is, they bought it. We can begin. And it's like, oh, right there. He just said the whole thing's a wild goose chase, you know? But you don't immediately think that because you're with John and Samuel Jackson. You're like, oh, God, we got to find this bomb. And it's like, oh, wait. Did he just say the whole thing's fake? Damn it. That fashion mullet got me again. But I mean, it's yeah, and then of course, and I've mentioned it a million times, my favorite line in this entire movie is delivered by an uncredited extra about 5 minutes into the movie, and it's the black guy that yells, "The f-," you know, when he's running the basketball courts in the street and he sees John's sign.
Yeah,
it's my favorite line delivery of all time. It's just so good. I hope that dude was given other roles just to yell that phrase on how good he did it in Die Hard with a Vengeance, you know? It's like, I'm the what the fuck guy.
When me and my mom were at Westville getting a couple beers watching the football games, and we were talking about our favorite movie lines, and she said one of her favorite lines ever was, get busy living or get busy dying. And I laughed because I'm like, oh, one of my favorite movie line ever is, you're now shooting a gun at your imaginary friend in front of 400 gallons of nitroglycerin.
Such a great line. It's such a great line.
Like they're both great lines, but I clearly enjoyed for different reasons.
Yeah, it's that self-referential like humor that Tyler Durden does have, you know, the oh great flashback humor, very nice. You know, it's all the, yeah, that line is absolutely phenomenal. But yeah, get busy living and get busy dying. No. But, and then of course there's the line that doesn't hold up in this movie. Yeah, and I'm gonna marry Donald Trump. No, you're not, man. For any number of reasons. But anyway, then there's also, and I hope this kid, I hope he's still alive somewhere, being the little street rat that he is. The kid that John steals the kid's bike, and he goes, come on, it's like Christmas. You can steal City Hall. You know? But this fucking like Brooklyn street rat.
You know what? You know what this movie's missing? A constable coming in and saying, what's all this then?
Oh, it's almost all this then. You were supposed to be taken internally, John. Just swap him out for like Colleen Kent. That'd be great.
He just comes in and train crash. What's all this then?
What's all this then? Colleen, you're going to be wearing your chair up your ass. What's all this then? That'd be great. Yeah, that's the one thing we don't have. We don't have like an Irish flatfoot. I mean, even though McLean is called that by Jeremy Irons, we don't have like the literal Irish constable, which would be great. All right, so, but that was the good one. That was Die Hard with a Vengeance, which thankfully my wife put in there because if we had to do, I mean, Groundhog Day would have been the one that was like, look.
If we got Groundhog Day, I wouldn't be that upset about this week. No,
but yeah, the other ones were rough. So, we'll get into the most problematic one next, but Mike, how's your beer?
Doing good. Just about finished it. As far as sweet beers go, they're crumb cake ones I can drink a lot of. Like, usually sweet beers give me a bit of a, like, I got to go slow with these. The crumb cake ones are light enough that I really like them from Westville, though. The peach was my favorite, but they don't have that. The peach and blueberry are still my two favorite, but they didn't have either on tap right now. The apple's good.
Nice. And my limited edition Oktoberfest lager from Hoppling Goliath was very delicious. You know, it also goes with Simon Peter Grupa. But yeah, delicious Oktoberfest, good shit. Way to go, Iowa. Now,
you know, what if Simon Peter Grupa showed up in Lederhosen?
He's in Lederhosen. Yeah, that'd be good, yeah. But now, speaking of the middle of the country, we have to go to Shermer, Illinois, which turns out, according to Jay from Jay and Silent Bob, there is no Shermer, Illinois. You know? But in this movie, there is. So it's Pretty in Pink from 1986, one of the quintessential 80s teenage movies, and it is referenced directly in the movie I watched like three times after watching this and 10 Things I Hate About You. I watched Not Another Teen Movie like a few times. I'll
I
probably watch it
love
again.
that another movie.
Well, because I went, because after watching 10, we'll get into 10 Things I Hate About You, but after 10 Things I Hate About You, I was like, wait, that's like 90% of what Another Teen Movie makes fun of. But in this, obviously the scene with Harry Dean Stanton and Molly Ringwald on the couch where she's talking about Blaine and all that, that is actually a clip shown in Not Another Teen Movie while Janie is asleep on the couch. But yeah, this was directed by Howard Deutsch and written by obviously the legend John Hughes. And
The fact that they cast John Cryer in this, that just tells me that they couldn't get Matthew Broderick.
let's discuss John Cryer in this movie, Ducky. Now, Ducky, as I was texting with Mike, Ducky in this movie dresses like every gay high school character that came after him. That's basically the wardrobe for every gay high school character in My So-Called Life and every modern Netflix show. That's pretty much how the cool gay kid dresses. All of it. It's always there. And the problem with Ducky is, though, that, and it's ironic because it's John Cryer, Ducky is basically Charlie Sheen's character from Two and a Half Men. And the problem is he's not successful at getting laid. And the only one he wants to fuck is Molly Ringwald. And he is the original incel. He is the original good guy that
That's
deserves the girl because he's been so nice to her.
wait that so I was looking, and apparently the original ending was Molly Ringwald ending up with Ducky. And I was like, wait, an 80s audience didn't go for that? I was
It's
like, I'm proud of you, 80s.
exactly. It's very, it's kind of mind blowing to find that out. And it sucks because Ducky is everything wrong with men, basically. He is everything wrong with men. He is an incel through and through. He is a friend zone prick through and through. He is the guy who thinks just because he's been nice and around her entire life, he should worship him like a god. It's fucking awful to watch. And until Ducky becomes a good guy at the end of the movie, the prom, prior to that, I want Ducky to walk in front of a bus almost every chance he gets, because everything that he does is so cringeworthy and so annoying and so disgusting because it's like, dude, take it easy, pump the brakes. She's clearly not interested in you and just wants to be friends with you. You need to stop trying to bang your best friend constantly. It's disgusting. And when she eventually goes out with Andrew McCarthy, who on this, according to this show, is Eric Stoltz, so go back to our Less Than Zero episode where I kept referring to him as Eric Stoltz. But Andrew McCarthy, which is odd because he is like a legitimately good dude. His only problem is the fact that he's rich. That's not even really his problem.
Watching this movie, all I could think of is, you remember the Family Guy episode, one of the early episodes where Peter goes back in time, changes history, and ends up married to Molly Ringwald?
Yes. Yeah, I can see that. Now that's the other thing with Molly, because of course she's at the end of another teen movie. Now with Molly,
Well, she's in
there,
all of them. All of them.
all of them. But the thing with her is, there was the beginning of this movie. She has what I can only refer to as the 80s look. She's got awful clothes on, which only were only fashionable in the 80s. She's got the worst haircut I've ever seen, which could only have been fashionable in the 80s. And just to look at her, you go, okay, this woman is probably 16, 17. She dresses as if she's like a 30-year-old middle school teacher. And everything about her look turns you off. There is nothing attractive about her.
So, yeah, watching this movie, I was like, I don't understand the 80s. Like, nothing about it. I just don't get it. I do not get the 80s. Like, no idea. Nothing. Don't have a clue.
There's nothing
to get. I was born in 97.
Yeah, there's nothing to get about the 80s. The 80s were a... Now, that's the thing. There is a meme out there where it's like the 80s in movies and TV. And it's like bright colors, all the snazzy, all that. But it's like then the reality of the 80s is just everything was brown. It's like everything was so goddamn brown. And yeah, everything was so drab. And all it's the 80s were a very weird time because people like Ducky could exist because the goal of every guy apparently was just to get laid. And it was a horny ass time, but AIDS was also present, so it was a tricky horny time. Like, you had to be very careful about your horniness. But then there were guys like James Spader, and if he were in this movie, the world would explode, the Billy Zabka bullies of the 80s. Now, Mike and I were discussing this, that James Spader, if you go by the universe of this movie, if Bill Zabka was in it, James Spader is the Cubs fan to Billy Zabka's White Sox fan.
It's kind of like my theory that was brought up before that Patrick Swayze and, Kurt Russell are the same person, just Kurt Russell was raised in Texas and Patrick Swayze was raised in California.
Exactly. Yeah, and in this it would be James Spader was the rich guy in Beverly Hills, whereas Billy Zabka was the city kid that moved to Beverly Hills. It's the fact that James Spader made such an amazing career at being like the rich snob asshole. Like, he was phenomenal at playing that character. Bill Zabka, on the other hand, was phenomenal at playing the rich snob asshole that would physically kick your ass. You know, that was the difference.
And it's crazy that James Spader was eventually Ultron.
But think about that. Is it crazy? Like, is it crazy that he ended up playing like an ultra supervillain? You know, no.
But now I'm like, all right, so like if Billy Zabka ended up in the MCU, who would he be?
He would be like Rocket. Or like Groot or something.
Yeah, Rocket, like, of the characters that exist, Rocket seems right.
That would be the attitude he had, because all of his characters, for the most part, especially Johnny Lawrence. Johnny Lawrence is probably the biggest example of this.
Especially with Cobra Kai going on now, too. Like, you know, with Cobra Kai going on, he might have been Yondu.
Could have been, yeah, but because Johnny Lawrence was that complete asshole that at the end realized he was being led by an asshole. He wasn't the biggest asshole himself. He was kind of like peer pressured into being the lead asshole. And then when he really goes against Priest at the end of Karate Kid, he's like kind of shown himself that he is kind of a decent dude. He just might be a bit of a prick.
Mm-hmm.
But James Spader, on the other hand, is very much that like emotional assassin. Like, he will destroy your life financially if he has to. Like, he will ruin you without throwing a single fist, you know. He will ruin you before the fight even begins, and it's over, because he's such like a connected Illuminati lunatic, basically.
But I gotta make you watch back when I was making you watch anime, I never made you watch Monster. You gotta watch Monster, because, like, the main bad guy in it, he hardly kills anyone himself. He just talks to them and eventually gets them to kill themselves.
Yeah, and that's kind of Spader, except he's just trying to ruin you. Like, he's just trying to, destroy you mentally, basically. Which is what he tries to do with Andrew McCarthy in this movie. And it's basically him just being rich. And he even says, he's like, dude, do you think it's about money? If I cared about money, would I do what I'm doing in my parents' house? You know, he's like fucking up his parents' house all day. He's like, money means nothing to me. It's like, because he has so much of it, the way he spends his time is just like, you know what? I have the resources just to devastate whoever I want to devastate. You know, I can bang whatever rich girls I want to do. But even then, I could be bored with it because I'm just that rich, you know? And what cracks me up, though, is this whole movie, is about the class divide in this Chicago suburb. Now, Molly Ringwald and Annie Potts are, well, Molly Ringwald specifically, because she's the one that goes to school, they're the poor people. Molly Ringwald is very much the poor kid from the other side of the tracks. Now, we're going to talk about Shakespeare in the next movie, but this one is essentially Romeo and Juliet. We got star-crossed lovers from two different sides of the world, and they have two different sides of experiences, and neither of their friends or family want them to be with the others, basically, simply because of the divide. Now, the little bit of the twist on that is that Harry Dean Stanton, professional player of drunks and lowlifes, is a good father. He just can't get over the fact that his wife left him. And he doesn't really have much money, but he loves his daughter, and he just wants her to be happy. Whereas on the other side, Andrew McCarthy, as far as we know, doesn't even have parents. I don't even think we're ever introduced to his parents. But he has friends. He has rich friends that don't want him to associate with the trash that they think is Molly Ringwald. And it's your classic snobs versus like slobs 80s trope.
Except not even close to as good as something like The Outsiders.
That, or even like Revenge of the Nerds or something like that. But it's played like it's this class thing. But then there's one point where Molly Ringwald is in the principal's office because she's been bullied by these rich girls basically every day. And what she essentially does every time is she doesn't snitch. Like she knows what happens to snitches. So every time she's asked, it's like, are they fucking with you? She's like, no, we're good. It's like, oh, all right, Molly, she's down. She knows not to snitch anybody out. But then at one point she's talking to the principal and she's like, yeah, you know, I can tell people won't even want me at the school and all that. It's like, it's a public high school where she's not at a private school. No, this is a public high school. You're going there, you know? No one can look at you and be like,
you gotta move to not go there.
It's like, you don't deserve to be here. It's like, what are you talking about? It's a public fucking school. But
it's not like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse where Miles is trying to get kicked out of the private school so he could go back to public school.
Right, exactly. And it's that part of it's just so weird because I'm like, look, focus on the romance of it and the two sides that don't want the two to be together and that these kids deserve each other and they're secretly in love and yada yada. Focus on that.
It's great that, like, so if it followed all the tropes, you would have ended up with Ducky, which would have made this movie awful.
Yeah, it definitely would have been like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, no, the prick doesn't get to get the girl. And even weirder is she is adamant at one point about not letting Andrew McCarthy drive her home because she doesn't want him to see where she lives. When we see her house, it's just a little, it's small and a little overgrown. It's really just like a trimming of the hedges and mowing the lawn away from just being any suburb in Chicago, you know? We're not exactly going to like 8 Mile Detroit here. You know, we're not in, you know, the dregs of the projects of Chicago. You know, this girl just happens to live on a little bit poorer side of town.
I'm sorry that I'm not quite upper middle class.
Exactly. I'm still middle class, but I'm just not super rich. And it's the dumbest thing the 80s ever came up with, trying to make Richies a thing. It's like, no. That's not what you call rich people. Just call them yuppies like everyone else does. But
yeah, you don't have the writers of Mean Girls to come up with your slang for you.
The plastics. Yeah, like the plastics would have been great. But then there's the whole side plot of they can just be gone. And it is of Harry Dean Stanton missing his wife, lying about having a job, all that stuff. It's like, I don't need that. I don't need it. Just get rid of it. Make him Randy Quaid's character from Not Another Teen Movie. Just make him a fall down drunk who happens to love his daughter, you know? Just make him like that lovable drunk. I don't need him to have this weird sad sack story or
we don't have to imagine the dad just staying up at night drinking alone.
Right. But then there's the fact that he like puts on like business clothes and like pretends to go to a job at one point and comes back with a prom dress for her. It's like, and she's like, Dad, how long have you not had a job? It's like, where did you get this money from? I know you don't go to the job you're telling me you're going to. It's like, why is he going so far to keep up the ruse, you know? Who else is this for?
Listen, but, he commits to a bit.
you gotta give him that. But then, all right, Mike, in this movie, we've done it before. There are three cameos of big stars. Each one bigger than the one before, I will say. So do you know who they are? One of which has several speaking lines, and he is arguably the biggest one. I said he, so that gives it away. That should give it away.
Andrew Dice Clay's in it.
That's the one is probably the biggest name.
Yeah.
Then did you catch the other two? The other two, one is a brief shot at the very end of the movie, and the other is a, oh shit, that's her.
No, I didn't catch the other two.
All right. Duckette at the end is the girl that Ducky sees at the prom. It is the first credited appearance of Buffy the Vampire herself, Kirsty Swanson.
Huh.
Now, there's also one of the rich girl's friends is Gina Gershon.
Oh, I did catch Gina Gershon. I wasn't thinking of it.
I saw that. I was like, oh shit, is that Gina Gershon? Oh my God. That's great.
Yeah, I did catch Gina Gershon.
Yeah. But it's... Then, of course, there's Annie Potts looking like Ongogablogian at one point. And it's Annie Potts. I want to see the Annie Potts story, because I just kind of want to hear... I want to see, like, the brief cut scene of how she ended up tied up in the back of that guy's truck, in that guy's back seat. When she's on the phone in the beginning. It's because I got him tied up in your back seat. I was like, wait, rewind. Let's put this other stuff.
Why is the scene in this movie?
See this. I really need to see this scene, Annie. I can't really get past it. You need to start talking. And it's just everything about this movie is not so much technically rom-com, but this is the quintessential, like, 80s
teen comedy
teen movie. Yeah. And it's not quite Breakfast Club, but it's better than 16 Candles. And it's just, it's kind of okay. The biggest problem is Ducky. And that is more than likely just a result of the 80s being the 80s and times changing. And the only other thing is, though, and it's retrospective because it's funny, John Cryer at one point basically was like, yeah, I didn't know Ducky was gay then, but he's basically gay. And I was like, yeah, that would have been a better way to play the character. You know? If he was like trying to butch up, you know, like Simon tells the dude in the van in Diary of the Vengeance, Cheryl trying to butch up by chewing on her glasses. Yeah. So it's like, that would be fun. If the 80s were allowed to have that character be struggling with his sexuality, that's what that character should have done. Which is ironic, because it's probably why he inspired the gay fashion trends of kids in entertainment after that. Like, you really can't look at a quote-unquote not cool gay kid in a movie or TV and not see them looking in some way like Ducky.
John Cryer should be in Glee.
Exactly. He should have been a teacher or something like that. And apparently, because it was long after I stopped watching the show, apparently at one point in Two and a Half Men, John Cryer for a Halloween episode did dress up as Ducky again. And I'm sure the two or three people that actually gave a shit about Pretty in Pink and Two and a Half Men probably lost their mind. You know, I'm willing to bet it's a very small sliver of a Venn diagram.
There's also, I think it's one of the earlier episodes where there's the running gag where he just goes, I didn't want to play this card, but I am Matthew Broderick.
Like, yeah, it's because Matthew Broderick was, you know, he was Ferris at this point, and or he was about to be Ferris. I can never remember if Ferris is in 87 or not, but it would have been, I don't know. Matthew Broderick, I don't think could have played that role. I don't think he could have, because his ego seems cool to me. His ego seems to me that he would have had to be Andrew McCarthy. Like, he would have had to have been Blaine. But yeah, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, same year as this. So this is 86. So I guess Ferris was just busy. But Christy Swanson wasn't, because she's in both. But it's one of those movies where, like, yeah, it if you watch it nowadays, you understand that no, this does not hold up because of this one character. Like, the overall themes of the rest and James Spader being an asshole, it's timeless. But Ducky ruins it.
Yeah.
Especially with that stupid ass dance he does to give me a little tenderness or whatever the fuck. It's like, nah, dude, no. You're embarrassing yourself. Just stop. So that has been Pretty in Pink. Moving on to the last one, but before that, Mike, how's your beer?
Doing good. Just about done my second one. And yeah, as far as sweet beers go, I could drink plenty of their of Westville's crumb cake line.
Nice. Yeah, my Poppling Goliath drank nicely. But now I'm moving on to Two Roads. And let me pour. I'm pouring. Stupid tall boys pour forever. And, all right, so it's Two Roads Oktoberfest style Mosin Lager. And 5.8%. It is Ein Prost. But Stratford, Connecticut is where Two Roads is. And they always make a pretty good solid beer. And this is a good one. Now, on to the movie I did not expect to remember so differently. I remember because obviously in 1999, I was 17 years old. I had a girlfriend who made me watch this movie. And I remember not liking it. I remember thinking, this is fucking retarded. No, sorry about that, but
it's kind of decent.
It's not bad. It is not bad. When you look at it,
all the rom-coms we've watched so far, this is the one I would pick.
The one, and it's again, it's not like Ducky. It's not like Ducky does not hold up. Ducky does not hold up. His mindset is shit. He is a garbage person. Julia Stiles' unique rebel in this movie is absolutely Janie and not another teen movie. Everything she says is designed to piss you off. And that is what that character was. I knew poor girls like that. I still know people like that. And that type of character is such a stereotype and cliche archetype character trope that it should be laughed at as hard as possible because of how ridiculous that human being is.
Except like, you think we all know people like it, so it's not that ridiculous.
Exactly. It's like you think you're the most unique individual in the history of the world when all you are is just another one of these people, you know? And when it comes down to the basic elements of this character, and I'm sorry if you're listening and you are one of these people, congrats, you're a dumb, annoying cunt. You're just an annoying cunt. No one cares that your entire purpose in life is to the opposite thing of anything else that anyone wants to do. You're just annoying. You're not subtle. No one liked you. You ruin things for everyone. And my favorite bit about this is the heightened reality of this high school that they live in, that Allison Janney's guidance counselor is writing like erotica during the school day on school computer, like while she's having meetings with with kids. And then there's the black teacher, the black English teacher, who is just pissed off all the time because Julia Stiles ruins every single day of his class. And he's kind of like the principal in 21 Jump Street, where he's like, I am one gay black kid getting punched away from a nervous breakdown.
All right, so this movie is one of those where I'm like, the actors make it work for me, because Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's the star of my favorite rom-com of all time with 500 Days of Summer.
I thought you were going to say The Dark Knight Rises.
Yes. Yeah. Now, the Dark Knight Rise would probably be like my 12th favorite rom-com if it was a rom-com.
It's not up in the top five. It's not in the top five, but it's there.
But, and Heath Ledger, who's just like, He's like slightly, he's like mysterious, but kind of unhinged, and I'm here for it.
The best thing is, now this is one of those like misremembering parts. I misremembered him being like Chris Hemsworth in Cabin in the Woods, like trying to play an American kid. But all he's really doing is just less Aussieing his accent. He's still got it. And they make a reference to the fact that he is not from around these parts. So like the accent makes sense, but you can tell he's tamping it down a little bit. So it's not fighting for its life like it is Cabin in the Woods against Chris Hemsworth. But and it doesn't sound like he's an Australian guy doing an impression of an American dude, but like poorly. Like it's he just has that like Heath Ledger voice, and it's fun. And he's got a little bit of that like Brandon Lee in The Crow kind of look to him, and except without the makeup and everything. It's like, all right. And what cracks me up though is he's just like a regular dude that it turns out, and I don't know where any of it came from, has the greatest like mythology in the school. Everyone comes up with some other crazy thing about this guy, and he's like, I honestly don't know where he came from.
That's kind of like so like in Scott Pilgrim versus the World, Ramona Flowers gets that kind of mythology at the party, but there is something mystical about her to some extent, where this, he's just like, yeah, they're just kind of making shit up about me.
And that's like him and Julia Stiles go back and forth about the various different things that had been made up about either of them, with a couple of hers are actually just true. Where she kicked that dude's testicles like into his chest. Mm-hmm. Because he like grabbed their ass or something like that. She's like, oh no, that one's true.
But we gotta talk about the best person in the movie, Larry Miller.
Larry Miller, again, professional asshole. The dude's always playing some sort of jerk. And I think we last talked about him. Was it Necessary Roughness we last talked about him?
Yeah, I brought him up because for some reason Max Keeble's big movie came up and he plays the vice principal in that.
Really? Okay. But yeah, I mean, Larry Miller, he was always in this one. It's okay. It was a thing, and people find it hilarious. I find it grating and annoying, but he is very much he's an overprotective father because he is an obstetrician. He delivers babies all day, and most of them are from, apparently they're all from teenage girls. And that's his fear with his two daughters, which are Bianca and Julia Stiles. And Bianca is played by Larissa Olenek. Now, we'll get to the fun connections between Larissa Olenek and then Andrew Keegan to real life nut jobs. But these two are sisters, and Larry Miller's her father. And he is basically like, I can't handle this shit. You leaving this house gives me nerves, like makes me nervous and gives me anxiety just because I have this fear that you'll get pregnant by walking by, guys. You know, it's just completely irrational. And everything he says has to do with the fact that they'll get pregnant by something. It's like, look, dude, I get it. You're supposed to be crazy and supposed to be funny, but after a while, it's just dumb. You know, after a while, it's just annoying. But it is Larry Miller.
Yeah, that's what Larry Miller. I'm like, I can just watch Larry Miller be high strung and insane for hours.
He always comes up with something good. And I mean, what's one thing that he does? I forget what he does where he...
I love when he puts like the pregnant suit on her. He's like, if you're thinking about doing it, just remember what this feels like.
You're gonna wear the belly. So I want you to wear the belly. Make sure to walk around it for a couple minutes. But well, I'm trying to think of the thing he does where he throws something off of the deck, and then his neighbor throws it back, and he's like, "Oh, thanks, Bill." I forget what it is though.
I'm going to steal this joke from CinemaSins because I usually when I watch these movies, I watch the CinemaSins to them too. But yeah. When he's talking about the rules, he's like, rule one, no dating till you graduate. Rule two, he's like, what's my only rules? He's like, no dating till you graduate and no dating till you graduate. CinemaSins was like, oh, those are the only rules? So like, I can do heroin.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, if it was that simple, that'd be great. But then there's, what was it? It's Allison Janney that has this line, I think, when she's talking to Julia Stiles in her office in the beginning. I believe it's her that has the line that is, heinous bitch is the term that's used most often to describe you. Heinous bitch. But, and then the one kid, she's like, yeah, and Larry, whatever, he's like, Johnny, whatever's testicle retrieval operation went very well. And she's like, I still maintain that he kicked himself in the balls. It's like, all right, that's funny. But then there's the line that after Julia Stiles backs into Andrew Keegan's Camaro in the car, the line that Larry Miller has, whereas my insurance doesn't cover PMS. That's a good line, too. But
this movie, then, did, like, there were several laughs in this movie for me.
Oh, yeah, no. My favorite line, and I forget why, and well, it reminds me of my college roommate. My roommate's sophomore year is this guy named Kofi. He was from Ghana. He was the funniest dude I've ever met. He's fucking hilarious. He drove a Toyota Tercel. So when David Krumholtz at the party goes, yeah, I'm thinking of getting a Tercel. Yeah, it's a Toyota. Just like flash me back to that, because in that time when I knew Kofi, there were people that knew he drove a Tercel, and that's like the lines that they would quote back and forth to him. Like, yeah, I'm thinking about getting a Tercel. It's a Toyota. Then when you remember what a Toyota Tercel is, it's just a piece of shit.
That's tiny, so I'm trying. Car. I'm curious when the last year the Tercel was produced.
I'm willing to bet it was like 2000. It was probably not much farther than this. But there's, and that's the other thing with David Krumholtz's character. And David Krumholtz is so funny in this movie. And it was 1999 was the last year that the Tercel was produced.
So the Tercel stopped being produced when I was two.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. It became the Saluna in Thailand and Indonesia and stuck around again until about 2003. But yeah, the original run of the Tercel was until 1999. But it was essentially the Corolla is what took it over, you know. And it's not a good car. But David Krumholtz is so good in this because he is the kind of the ringleader for all of the shenanigans that Joseph Gordon-Levitt puts Heath Ledger through. And it's just these two little morons like trying to get the cool kid to do stuff for him. And yeah, it's just funny as hell. But then,
which really, so like Heath Ledger's lines, he's like, yeah, some assholes paid me to take this girl out.
Yeah. And it's funny because, again, this entire movie is basically not another teen movie, down to the fact that this begins with David Krumholtz walking Joseph Gordon-Levitt through the quad with all of the clicks and everything. It's like the Mean Girls opening. It's like the Mean Girl scene. But this is almost exactly the opening of also after the masturbation scene in Not Another Teen Movie, where the dude from How I Met Your Mother is walking everybody through. He's like, all right, let's break up into smaller groups. You jockey guys over there. You dirty sluts over there. You nerds back there. He's like, great, congratulations. These are the only people you'll ever hang out with for the next 4 years.
Which is also hilarious when you think about a show like Wednesday, where she's getting walked through the school and they're like, oh, those are the werewolves. Those are the vampires.
Exactly, exactly. And then, now, here's the fun part. Larissa Olenek, who plays Bianca, she was the star of a show called The Secret World of Alex Mack on Nickelodeon. It was a very popular show. This girl had, like, I don't know, superpowers or something.
Crazy,
it was very
popular show. Pre-me Nickelodeon.
Yeah, it was a very popular show. This girl was
very big. Was that before all that?
Yeah, or it was right around the same time. Yeah, but it was after Clarissa Explains It All. So your Melissa Joan Hart, who appears in Not Another Teen Movie, she was like the Larissa Olenek was like the follow-up to Melissa Joan Hart. Now, when I was thinking this, I'm like, Alex Mack, why do I remember Alex Mack being like in a cult or something? So I looked it up. It's not Larissa Olenek. Larissa Olenek, as far as we can tell, is an upstanding law-abiding citizen. But Allison Mack, who was an actress on some show, she was in Nexium, which was a literal cult. And it was like, she was she was in charge of recruiting girls to get raped and like sex, like of sexually abused and all that. So yeah, Allison Mack, complete garbage human being and a nightmare to exist in this world. Then there's our friend Andrew Keegan, who is the he's the cool dude in this movie. I can't remember what the hell his character's name is. What is it? But he is Andrew Keegan is Joey in this. And Andrew Keegan in real life started his own religion, basically. And it's called Full Circle. Now, it was apparently, it's supposed to be like this non-denominational, yada, yada, yada. It's cult speak is what it is. This is essentially another cult. Now, the fun part about this is it's not like the everyone gets raped, everyone gets brainwashed kind of cult. It's just someone going there, and what happened with them and why they ran afoul of the law is that the California Board of Alcohol and Beverage Consumption raided them because they were distributing illegal kombucha. Of all things for the cops to raid you for, it's illegal alcoholic.
You're making drinks. A drink out of fermented mushrooms.
Fucking assholes, you goddamn kombucha dealers. Damn you. You know what you're doing to the kids in this neighborhood?
Yeah, with Marissa Olenek, I just had to look up and make sure she wasn't related to Kelly Olenek. Olenek is spelled differently in their last name.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think they are. But
I really wanted to, because like I would have found it way cooler if they were like siblings.
Yeah, that would have been fun.
But their last names are spelled differently.
Right. Well, yeah. And again, most of this movie, and obviously this is Heath Ledger's first like breakout role, like his first major role, his big breakout role. He apparently like improvised the scene where he's just kind of whipping his fingers through the Bunsen burner to kind of be an asshole.
I mean, just watching this movie, you could tell like the natural charisma he had.
Oh, absolutely. There is not a single, the fact that even the fact that he is allegedly like the psychopath bad boy, this dude would be picking girls off him like left and right, because that is the exact character type that every woman in every movie loves.
You look at him and you go, this dude is destined to be Sir Ulrich von Liechtenstein and dancing to
what?
A Knight's Tale.
Yeah, I know it's a Knight's Tale, but the thing is though, really, while they're filming this and he's making out with Julia Stiles and all that, do you ever think that they just sat there and were like, you know what, Julia Stiles, I have a weird feeling about the rest of my career. I feel like I'm going to burn pretty bright. I might end a little early. I might die early. But I feel like before that, people are going to really remember me for fucking Jake Gyllenhaal in the ass. Like, I have a weird feeling that I'm going to go from this to Jake Gyllenhaal in the woods, you know, in the mountains. I don't know. I feel like it's going to happen. What about you? And she's like, well, I feel like I'm going to dance with a black guy in this next movie. People are going to remember that shit. And then I'm going to kind of fall off the face of the earth until Jason Bourne comes around. So, but yeah, I get the feeling you're going to fuck Jake Gyllenhaal in the ass. I get a weird feeling about him. When like Donnie Darko comes out, Jake's just like, oh, wait. Oh, no. I feel like my career path just took a turn. A little bell goes off. He's like, oh no. I wonder if I could become a top before then. Because I'm going to be a bottom. It's happening. I feel it. God. Joker's going to fuck me in the ass.
Oh, God.
And then Andrew Keegan's over there like, guys, I got some fermented kombucha. You want to try it? It's like, no, 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 God.
Hey, hey, all kombucha is fermented. That's part of the process of making it.
Whatever. What? I mean, it's just, it's so funny. And then,
you know, Knives Out, the Glass Onion, they mention that Jared Leto makes some alcohol kombucha. So you never know. You never know.
There you go. And Mike, you just said his name. He is mentioned in this movie. Do you remember how?
No.
Bianca is talking to Joseph Gordon-Levitt about his sister, about her sister. And of course, the rule is that Bianca can't date until Julia Stiles dates. And Julia Stiles is erection murdering. She's just an erection murderer. So that's never going to happen. But Bianca does say that at one point, she found a picture of Jared Leto in her drawer once. And she says, but I'm pretty sure she's not harboring same-sex tendencies. And it's like, okay, just we're going to ignore that last part there. But the fact that Julia Stiles might be rubbing one out to Jared Leto, that's a character trope. That's a character trait of this girl, apparently. Now, remind you.
You know what? Given the girl's character, I buy it.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the other thing. In 1999, what would our boy have been doing? Would that have been the...
Just been after Requiem.
That would have been the My So-Called Life years, right?
It's right before Requiem.
Yeah, and so he would have been popular from My So-Called Life. That's what he would have done. Prefontaine would have already come out. Urban Legend would have come out. Thin Red Line was out. Fight Club was the same year. And then, of course, American Psycho was afterwards. But yeah, Requiem for a Dream was right after that. But yeah, this would have been the My So-Called Life, Jared Leto. And that was back when he was still kind of tolerable, you know? But yeah, it's...
Yeah, before I was born.
Mike has only known the insufferable Jared. He has never known the heartthrob high school boy in My So-Called Life.
Pre-memory me gets what, Prefontaine. I've heard decent things about that. Urban Legend, Fight Club, this, American Psycho, Requiem for a Dream. Then we get to me actually having some memory. And I get 30 Seconds to Mars and Dallas Buyers Club.
That's about when the insufferable part happened. But yeah, and it is funny that I mentioned Jared Leto of all people. But then there is the scene in this movie that because it was only able to happen in the 90s. Because I feel like after 9/11, somebody would have pointed this out as being a problem. There is this scene where Julia Stiles is trying to get Heath Ledger out of detention. She is distracting the teacher. She's making up bullshit while Heath Ledger sneaks out the window. And
she flashes him.
She flashes him for a good, like, 20 seconds, maybe? So, like, he could have counted, you know, like, the pores around her nipples. Like, that's how long this flash is. And it's... She just kind of puts him away, and then she's like, hurry, bye, and then she runs out, and it's like, wait. At what point is A, somebody twisting this so that he goes to jail for seeing a minor's tits, or B, what is she going to face some sort of discipline for flashing a teacher, or are we just cool with that?
It's the 90s.
It's the 90s. It's in Seattle or it's in Washington. It's like, I guess maybe they're a little looser with the mores.
You notice it didn't rain once. It says place in Seattle, Washington, and there's not a single scene with rain in it.
There's also not a single scene with rain in it. I don't think it rains at all in this movie either.
That's what I just said.
I thought you said brain. I was like, wait, I don't know. Fuck you, I'm drunk.
I said brain.
Yeah, fine, whatever. Who cares? Cut that. Just cut this part out.
Motherfucker, vampires move out there just because it's constantly cloudy and rainy.
Well, that's the thing. This is a pre-Twilight world, so the Cullens aren't there yet.
Hey, they might have been.
They might. Well, yeah, true. They probably were, because this would have been what, like the third go round in high school for them, because they got to collect those fucking graduation caps or whatever. Ugh. Yeah. Okay, sorry. I don't listen to most of the things you say, Mike. So when you say things, I just say what I was going to say anyway.
But, you know, since I was growing my beard out, my friend saw me. He said, next year you need a girlfriend so that for Halloween you could be Yukon Cornelius and she can be the Bumble.
Yes, that would work perfectly. One of the things I don't get about this movie is, and maybe it's deleted scenes that I'll never see, why does Gabrielle Union like turn heel in this movie? Like, she just becomes a bad guy out of nowhere.
I don't know. I was confused by that.
Yeah, she and Bianca are like best friends until Bianca realizes Andrew Keegan's an asshole. And then Gabrielle Union's like, well, I'm going to jump on that dick. And then I'm going to be a bitch afterwards. Okay. Sure. All right.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, again, not another teen movie, and this movie nailed both, because Jamie being her unique rebel, listening to Bikini Kill, doing all this, it's literally like she's saying all of the things that Julia Stiles does in this movie. And it's the type of thing that had to be parodied in the last good spoof movie, because it's such an arch cliche character. And it's like, yeah, we get it, but in reality you're just a psychopath. That's all you really are. You're really just a bitch. That's all you are. And sure, you may have different opinions than the rest of your high school kids, but no one cares. Literally no one cares. You're just making things worse for everyone else. Because everything you say in your English class pushes your teacher that much closer to suicide, and makes every other person in your class just do the, you know, like that. And it's kind of like the scene in Not Another Teen Movie where Ducky, the Ricky character, gets up and does his poem. And that right there is supposed to be kind of making fun of the poem that Julia Stiles does at the end of this.
It's the thing where it's like, oh, the kid who is super obsessed with mythology goes into history class and they're teaching something and he goes like, well, actually, this is how it happened.
It's like, no one cares, dude. No one cares. Your shit's not going to be on the test. You know? We just need to know what the teacher thinks, and then we'll just write that down, and we'll pass, and we'll have our own thoughts later. We just don't care. But what cracks me up, though, is when she's, like, genuinely sincere about writing the poem. The teacher thinks that she's, like, making fun of him. He's like, just go to the office. Fuck out of here. She's like, no, I'm genuinely, I need to get out.
You know what would have been great? If Jonah Hill just showed up and did his slam poem from 22 Jump Street.
That would be phenomenal. That would be phenomenal. Like, he's doing like the little like rain or whatever that hand motion is that he does. But, I mean, yeah, it's... And then you look at this, because, again, Not Another Teen Movie pointed out 2 years later, Julia Stiles' character is just a lesbian, right? She's really just a lesbian.
Yeah.
And because all of her tendencies are, I'm not saying that being antisocial makes you a lesbian, but all of her feelings towards guys are your stereotypical, like, lesbian feelings. They're just she's like the man-hitting lesbian, basically. And
this is exactly what Mr. Garrison goes through after a sex change operation.
Exactly. And it's kind of like, It's the 10 years after Ducky, female version of Ducky. Like, because it's 1999, she can't be out, because the 90s were still not cool with kids, teenagers being gay. You know, they gotta keep it under wraps for a little bit longer until it's cool around Obama coming like into office. But in this, it's like, yeah, all of the signs are there. Like, she was spurned by Andrew Keegan, like she gave it up to Andrew Keegan and then realized he's a complete prick and she probably hates all men, but she doesn't quite want to be with women all the time. So it's like, yeah, she's just like either asexual or completely homosexual. And it's like, we just couldn't do that in the 90s. And it would have made more sense. Hell, it might have been in a funnier movie if she's secretly gay the whole time and just like leading Heath Ledger along. Oh, just to letting him do his thing.
Yeah.
Like, that would have been kind of a funnier movie. If at the end she's like, oh, no, I've been gay this whole time. It's like, sorry. Thanks for the guitar. I'll catch you later.
Yeah, that would have made for a better ending, I think.
That would have been interesting. But, yeah, and it's, I mean, again, though, as written, it is, going back to it some 24 years later, I was like, you know what? This is a lot better than I remember. I remember this being a lot better than it was. My 17-year-old self was not prepared to see this on the level that I should have seen it on, and, even though Not Another Teen Movie is the one that really brought it all home, you know, it's.
But you really, have some with how much we've talked about it, we really didn't talk about Joseph Gordon-Levitt much.
He's not really in the movie that much. He's really just like kind of running in the background and like being treated like shit by Bianca until he calls her on it. And then after that, it's just like two kids that can't date because Julia Stiles is the main character and she's the one that we really want, the storyline we really want to follow. So they're kind of pushed to the back.
Oh, also, but I really don't like the plot. The one that plot line that like I really don't like was where she's like blackout drunk and Heath Ledger's like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do anything about this. And then she's like mad about it. She's like, yes. I'm embarrassed that you didn't do anything. Like, no, it's okay to be embarrassed by your actions. And maybe you let that reflect onto your feelings for Heath Ledger because he was present, but then you gotta apologize for that because that's on you, not on him. But no, she's mad at him for not taking advantage of her when she was drunk.
Exactly. She's being a gentleman and gets shit on for it. Yeah. I was like, wow, that's such a 90s mentality. It's like, dude, you had the chance to get laid. But you were a gentleman about it. What the hell's wrong with you? But it's coming from the girl on the receiving end. We're like, the problem is that he doesn't say, look, you were hammered, so I didn't want you to do anything you might regret. So I was thinking about you in that situation. So like, he never says that. So we're basically just like, you're supposed to believe what she says in the sense that he was like, nah, dog, I'm cool. You know, but in reality, he mentions it to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And it really should have been said to her, you know.
But also, like, she should realize that she was way too drunk to do anything. Absolutely. And regardless of why he rejected her, rejecting her was the right thing to do.
Exactly. Yeah. It definitely, she should have definitely been like, you know what? I get it. I might have been mad for like that night in the morning, but then I realized, hey, wait.
Like, again, it's okay for her to be embarrassed about how she was, and to it's not a healthy thing to reflect it onto someone else, but it's an understandable thing. And then you apologize to that person and go like, I was mad at me, not mad at you, and I shouldn't have lashed out at you.
Yeah, this is, it's definitely a we need conflict between these two characters, part of the formula of the rom-com. And of course, this movie's also Taming the Shrew. You know, it's all of these things have to happen. And speaking of the Shakespeare allusions in this, Patrick, aka Heath Ledger, his last name is Verona. How fucking subtle, you know? It's like, what are we doing? And then at one point, Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the beginning, when Bianca does her slow motion entrance to the port, wherever they are, to school, and it's like Lacey Chabert in another teen movie. He quotes Taming of the Shrew there, and I was like, come on, what are we doing?
Do a Hamlet reference and everyone die at the end.
Yeah, do something, you know? But, and of course, there's Heath doing the singing, I Want You Baby or something is what he sings on the on the steps, whereas in another teen movie, Janie's got a gun, which is even funnier. But yeah, it's I recommend this movie, but I also highly recommend watching this and then Not Another Teen Movie right after it. Because this movie has a direct connection to Not Another Teen Movie. Do you know who it is, Mike? Direct connection, and it's the same actor playing the role.
Same actor.
Yeah,
all
there's
right
one
it's not
actor
one of
that
our main characters, right?
no, it is a he is a background character that has a little bit of screen time.
All right, is it gonna guess Kyle Cease
That is correct. That is correct.
as Bogey?
He is Bogey Lowenstein. He is the party haver in this movie. He is also the slow clap guy in Not Another Teen Movie.
All right.
Yeah, he's also attending Preston Wasserstein's party in that movie, which is supposed to be that same scene. But yeah, it's and Daryl Mitchell is Mr. Morgan, the teacher that we have in. The black teacher has just had enough of Julia Stiles and all of her bullshit. But yeah, it's this movie is it's good, it's fine. And it's some great Ledger. It really is. I'm not
As
a fan
far
of
as
Julia.
rom-coms go, this is one of the better ones.
Yeah, and I'm not a giant Julia Stiles fan, but she's fine in this. Like she's just fine. And of course, if you want to see some good minor Allison Janney, she's in here too. And then great Larry Miller. It actually is. It's a watchable little movie. I'll tell you that. It is a watchable movie. It is this by far is probably the best week we're gonna have when it comes to this.
Yeah, I mean, like, Pretty in Pink isn't great, but it's not terrible.
No, it's not. But it's one of the classics and it's just fine. It's one of those movies that doesn't hold up in retrospect kind of thing. But judging by what's coming next, we're not I'm straight up not gonna have a good time. So before we talk about next week, Mike, where can people find us?
You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, and just about anywhere else you get your podcast from. Thanks to Spotify Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at Happy Hour Films Podcast.
You know, I discovered it. It's not new, I don't think.
All right, Chris,
Discovered
let's
him.
do this.
Yeah, I'm gonna take credit. White guy's gonna take credit for discovering something he didn't fucking discover. But I discovered this podcast called God Awful Movies, where they talk about a Christian movie, like or a Christian themed movie every week, and they fucking make fun of it all day. It's great. But one of the hosts does the recap thing, like where you can find him and all that, and then like there's a lot of like other credits that he gives, but he does it in like Micro Machines guy like speed. And Mike, you just rattling off like Mike, like Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff. It's like, yeah, you're doing that for like 5 seconds. He does it for like 30. But he just keeps going and going. It's like, how? And he like doesn't really miss a beat or stutter. I was like, how does this dude get
Well,
this?
I started doing it quick because Tyler and his girlfriend were making fun of me for how long it used to take me to getting through that. So I was like, all right, fuck you, I'm doing it quick now.
Get fucked. So, all right. So now you know where to find us. But next week we have to continue with Rom-Com Roulette. Now, luckily, each of these weeks we do have a good movie to watch. Like one of the good movies got picked. Now, this one though, I think my wife put it in thinking it might have been a rom-com, but Scott Pilgrim versus the World is the one that we'll be talking about. We briefly
Fucking
mentioned that
love that
tonight.
movie.
We have talked about it before with our Edgar Wright episode. We will also be talking about the two definite rom-coms of Bad Moms and Jerry Maguire. Yeah, fucking I having the misremembered hatred of 10 Things I Hate About You this week will not apply for Jerry Maguire here because I remember seeing a movie, hating that movie, and more than likely hating it this time around too, because Tom Cruise got charisma, but not that fucking movie. I absolutely despise that movie. And of course, that's where we
I've
get one
never
of
actually
the
seen it before, if I'm being honest.
you're not
I
missing
know the
anything.
show me the money.
That, and we also get the legendary rom-com line of "You had me at hello," and there's the "Who's coming with me" scene, which is parodied in Half Baked when he quit when Jim Brewer quits his job. But it's yeah. So we're talking about those three movies, and until next week, I have been Ross Bacon.
I've been Mike McGuigan.
We'll see you guys next time. So long.